smoking gun that the critics of the church have been looking for, but it is very interesting to, you know, if you're interested in those kind of things. I guess, Craig, I kind of feel like, you know, whatever the church wants to do with my money is fine with me, so I haven't really gotten all worked up about these kinds of issues in the past, but it's interesting to me from the standpoint of maybe, you know, helping us to understand a little bit better what church finances, how they're organized, where they go, and it does help respond to some of the concerns that people have raised. And, of course, there is the recent publication by Michael Quinn about church finances that was deeply disappointing to many of the critics of the church. They were, I think, disappointed that Mike Quinn didn't find the smoking gun and wasn't more aggressive in going after the church. But you've read that book, Craig.
I have read that book.
What did you think about it?
I actually thought it was a very interesting book. I thought that generally it was well done. In fact, I probably, of the three different volumes, there was The Mormon Hierarchy, Origins of Power, then Extensions of Power, and this is Corporate Power. I actually found that this was probably I think his best book, and what really made it interesting is that you know, true confession here, a number of years ago, I actually helped Mike do some research on the book. He had me look up some things for him. And so I have had an interest in church businesses for quite a while, actually. And as over the years, as I've heard critics of the church, you know, complain about this or that, The thing that has amazed me is that you know, everyone they keep trying to find this deep dark you know, conspiracy of you know, using all of the money, you know, that the members have given for this or that. And what is remarkable is if you've looked at the various articles over the years, Inc. Did one a number of years ago, and then there was another one by Time and Business Week, if I remember correctly. But anyway, each of those articles, while they have certainly played up, you know, how much the church is worth and all of that, they have also commented on how carefully the money is spent. That these church leaders really do take a great responsibility on themselves to treat the money as sacred money. Now, I've been interested for quite a while, and I've done research on what I refer to as the second echelon elite. You know, we have the church hierarchy, and the second echelon elite would be people, mostly those who were bishops or stake presidents in the Salt Lake area, but some of them didn't even really hold any important ecclesiastical positions, but were still important in business. The reason why I was doing that, I've been doing research, sheesh, for about 30 years off and on a bishop in Salt Lake City by the name of John Sharp. And so I have looked carefully at his business dealings. And one thing that has frustrated me when I've heard critics of the church, they've talked about how these men, they all got wealthy off of using church funds, you know, for this and that. And so what the church has today, you know, was all tithing money, and that was a bad way to use it. Well, from the there's a an article that is on Fair Mormon titled City Creek Center Mall in Salt Lake City. So obviously it's a little bit old news, but But I thought this was interesting. It says the church used what precious funds it could to build infrastructure and provide for the needs of the people. In the process, the church and its leading members created companies like Deseret Bank and Zions Bank, Deseret Produce Company, Deseret Salt Company, Deseret Telegraph, Deseret Manufacturing Society, Deseret Iron Company, Jordan River Canal Company, Davis Canal and Irrigation Company, Utah Central Railroad, Utah Southern Railroad, and Utah Northern Railroad, and a host of other companies. I have looked at information on most of those companies because of the individual that I've been doing research on was involved in those. And I can tell you right now, most of these companies, the men that invested, they invested hoping that they would succeed, but having a pretty good idea that given the church's track record, they probably would be losing their money in the process. And they did. With a number of these companies, they did pretty much lose their money. Now, yes, some of the companies that they created did very well and were, over the years, money makers. But most of them were not. And these men were not doing it to, you know, as a way to get rich quick or anything like that. They basically were giving everything they had, sometimes literally, to the building up of the kingdom of God. And so the money, yes, some tithing money was used, but also private funds were used where they basically donated that to try to, you know, accomplish what they needed to in terms of meeting the needs of the people in terms of services or infrastructure. The one thing that that I got out of this, both you know, my own research as well as reading Quinn's book, which, like I said, I found to be fascinating, and I thought that it was probably the best of the three volumes. I went to a presentation that Mike gave at Benchmark Books, and between what he said at that presentation and what I read in the book, here are a few takeaways. One of them is that, yes, the leaders of the church are given a salary, but that salary is minuscule compared to what they would be earning if they were out in the corporate world. Another takeaway, the church, the United States members, we basically fund the rest of the world when it comes to membership. The Quinn showed how a few occasions Canada has been able to meet its budgetary needs on its own. But that's only been a few times, and they were the only ones. Even the UK, which has had members since 1837, has not been able to reach its budgetary needs. And so the church, basically the U.S. members in their tithing supplement people around the world, particularly in nations like Latin America, Africa, and that. And I personally, kind of like you, I figure I'm giving that money to the Lord. I don't care how it's spent, but to be honest, as Mike Quinn was explaining that, I thought, good, because, you know, there are a lot of people out there who need the help, and I am more than happy to give what little I have to help people in other parts of the world.
Well, I agree, and I think I may have been able to get to Matt Bowen on the line with us. Matt, are you there?
I'm here.
Great.
Aloha.
So, aloha, Matt. Matt, I think if you've been able to pick up, we're talking about the recent, news release on the LDS newsroom at LDS.org. It was released on May 22nd, and it's talking about how the church manages its finances and responds to a number of different questions. I thought, you know, it was interesting here to see. A lot of this isn't new. It's not necessarily new news. A lot of it's pulling together lots of past statements by the church. There was actually a talk that President Hinckley gave a number of years ago, 1991 in General Conference. I recognize some of the information in this new press release from that talk. But it is interesting. Let me go ahead and go to a caller right now, and we'll see if they have some comments on this. Caller, you're on the air on KTalk Radio with the Interpreter Foundation. Do you have a question for us?
I want to chime in here a little bit if I could. Or
response to a number of different questions.
That's fine. It sounds like there's.
It's interesting here to see a lot of.
What's that?
Is there a radio going on in your background? Mm-hmm. I think I hear.
Radio on. You need to.
Am I on live?
You're on live right now. Could you turn your radio off so we can don't have
it's
the
off.
Going? Great. Okay, what's your question or comment?
Well, my question or comment is I'm pretty irritated about the church turning all these funds over to their own private organization.
Why are you irritated?
Why am I irritated?
Yeah.
Well, because my parents was down here in Utah County in the 1800s, and as far as I'm concerned, as an LDS person that's wondering, you've ruined this area. What do I get? You're building Zion. I don't get it. If you have these private organizations that, some do well, you were just saying that, and some don't. Well, who is the sum? Do I get, if I was to join the LDS Church, do I get a card that says, okay, here's your percentage? Here's your 401k right here.
Here's a comment or two. One, I don't want to be rude, but why should you get anything? Because
I shouldn't.
Yeah, so let me finish here. The church, most of the businesses that were started back in the 1800s, the church either sold or they went under. And as I was saying, yes, for some of those businesses, tithing funds were used, but most of them, they were private investments, but they were being done for the good of the community. Now,
who's the community? You?
No, actually, the community was back.
You
then.
Or me?
Would you like me to answer?
At the time, you understand there was nothing here, and so part of the process was trying to build a community. And so, you know, if you build a bank, if you build a railroad, if you build a sugar company, that's benefiting everybody in the community, and it's starting to build something where nothing existed before.
I probably have more credentials right now than anybody you can even imagine. My parents came down here in Utah County in the 1800s.
So did mine.
Okay. So, okay. If we could work together here and have a discussion about the business, put it in quotes or whatever, of Zion, or really establishing Zion, what are we doing? What I'm getting at is, okay, we're all going to make a profit here.
Well, let me ask you this: business in particular are you concerned about?
Well, maybe food, agriculture.
Okay, what food or agriculture business that the church owns currently are you concerned with?
Oh, my heck. You want me to count the ways?
Sure.
From the Sheba Farm over here in Saratoga Springs to Alberta down there, or my parents' farm over there near Saratoga Springs that they've all sold off. Build Zion.
Okay, so what has happened in the past, what has been the policy
the past, okay.
for the
past.
Sir, would you like to you know, let me answer this? Because
yeah, sure.
Believe it or not, I actually know what I'm talking about. So,
yeah,
I do know what I'm talking about. So what has happened in the past is when the church has had a farm or ranch property where it eventually, if there's been enough building, both commercial and housing around it, then what they'll do is they'll sell that. They use that money to buy other church and property.
We're gonna have to take a break,
and we'll pick this discussion up again when we come back. This is Interpreter Radio Show on KTalk Radio. Alright, we're back on the Interpreter Show. Again, our line to call in is 801-254-1640. And we're with the Interpreter Foundation, founded interpreterfoundation.org. And we're talking right now about the finances of the church. There was a Mormon Newsroom press release on May 22nd talking about church finances and responding to various questions that people have had about the church. You know, where does my tithing money go? And, you know, how are the funds used? And we have on the line with us right now an individual who is concerned about some of the ways that the church is using the money. In particular, he's raised a concern about some of the church welfare farms. We'll bring him back on the line right now. Are you still with us?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So thanks for holding on through the break.
Sure, yeah.
Again,
no problem. This is right up my alley.
Okay. Well, so again, let me just make sure I understand your concern. So you're worried about the fact that the church owns some welfare farms.
I'm not worried about that.
Oh, okay. Well, I misunderstood your question then. What was your question? You mentioned about the sheep farming down in Alberta. What was your concern then?
Well, no, it wasn't. It's not sheep farming down there. It's actually milk farming down there.
Okay.
See, that's how little you guys know about this stuff. I'll just back up. So if I was to join this church and give 10% to build Zion, okay, where does the money go?
All right. Well, let me go ahead and answer that. On the church's website, where we've been referring to on the newsroom press release, they directly answer that question. So what it says is, the church uses its resources to pursue the Lord's work by sharing the message of Jesus Christ throughout the world, building and maintaining places of worship to strengthen individuals and communities, providing welfare, humanitarian assistance, and emergency response to alleviate suffering and to help people achieve self-reliance, promoting spiritual and secular learning through the church educational system, that includes seminaries, institutes, universities, and other higher education initiatives, building and operating temples, and sustaining family history work to strengthen families, and supporting general institutional administration. Now, there are... There's an excess amount of money that is left over once these needs are attended to, and so the church invests those funds. They put them into what they call their reserve funds. So the church talks about what the reserves consist of. It says church members are taught to gradually build a financial reserve by regularly saving a portion of their income. The church applies this same principle to its own savings and investments. In addition to food and emergency supplies, the church also sets aside funds each year for future needs. These funds are added to church reserves, which include stocks and bonds, taxable businesses, agricultural interests, and commercial and residential property. Now, it goes on quite a bit from there, but I think the point is that the church tries to set aside some money for you know, emergency needs and to help make sure that the church has enough to be able to meet its core mission. And with that money, they're not just putting it under the bed of President Nelson. They are, it's like the parable of the talents, you know, they're not just burying it, they're putting it to good use so that they can multiply the amount of money there. And so one of the things that they do is invest in stocks and bonds. Some of the other things they do is invest in agricultural interests, such as, you know, a milk farm in Alberta. And that serves a dual purpose of helping to make sure that that money is put to good use and can actually result in a return in that investment. But in the case of agricultural interests, that can also help serve the purpose of providing welfare, humanitarian assistance, and emergency response to alleviate suffering and to help people achieve self-reliance. So does that answer that question, sir?
You just rambled on there, but it didn't really answer anything, because it's quite a really nice remark about suffering, the pain and suffering. Who are you talking about? You were talking about the corporations of the church. Who invests in that? Even if it was to fail or okay, if you buy stocks in something, okay? So I pay 10% tithing, okay? So my 10% went over here to so-and-so's farm, and you know what? The corn value went down. So did I lose? Or if the corn value went up, did I win?
You understand when you give that money to the church, that's
give.
That's right.
Give.
That's right. It's not an investment.
No, it's not an investment. It's because I believe that the Mormon, I believe in Jesus, I guess, you know, which I do. You know, I am LDS, but if I give 10%, okay, and all of a sudden my life falls apart like Job, who's going to save me?
So if your life falls apart like Job, then you can go and ask for assistance through the church welfare program.
Oh, yeah. I'm the guy that has done that. And so I'm going to make a movie about this in the next couple of days, about asking for help because of my life falling apart. Okay?
All right. Well, I look forward to seeing that movie. Did you have any other question or comment?
No, other than you guys make no sense. If I was to have anybody even join this church, I mean, I could not even imagine, because all of a sudden, well, the church has these businesses over here and it's okay, and that loses all this money, just give us 10%. I'm sitting up here on the hill in Saratoga Springs, I see all these guys or people that have moved in here since I was a kid, farmed the whole valley. There was not one house over here. And we got all these nice little steeples up there. 10%, I almost want to call them 10% steeples. Oh, come pay us 10% and you'll be saved. I'll see you.
All right. Well, we appreciate your call. You know, I think that he raised a number of points that we hear critics raising over and over. I was glad to have the opportunity to address some of those issues. We've got another caller calling in right now. Let me bring him on the line. Hello, you're on the air with the Interpreter Show. What's your question or comment?
Thank you. Yeah, I would like to join in the conversation.
All right. And so what's your question or comment?
Um, Well, the guy who's talking now has been talking for about 10 minutes. Yeah, I would like to talk a little bit about tithing.
Okay, what would you like to say?
You want me to tell you everything, and then when I get on the air, I say everything?
Oh, you're on the air right now.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I didn't know that. Sorry about that misunderstanding.
Oh, that's all right. I should be more clear. We're all trying to figure this out.
My goodness, I didn't know I was on the air. Yeah, the way I look at tithing is that's the first place my money goes. And it's an honor to build the kingdom of God here on the earth. God doesn't need my money. This world is His. All the gold and silver, diamonds, everything in it is His. And Jesus Christ, it's all theirs. And I'm glad that I can make out a living from this earth that He has given us. You know, I'm glad I can go to school and develop my talents, and if my business goes bad, that I can go back to school and redo my talents and everything and support my family and improve myself. But that, you know, that 10%, I mean, I'm surprised God doesn't ask for 20 or 30 or 40 or 100%. But, you know, when you go to a man's wallet, you know, to me, that's commitment. You know, it's one thing to talk words and to do different things, but when you're really willing to share a portion of the fruits of your labors, and God gives us air, He gives us our bodies, He gives us everything. I mean, I'm grateful, you know, for my body and my life and my intelligence to give only 10% to the building of the kingdom of God. And I'm not worried about getting anything back. You know, in fact, I give more than 10%. I also, you know, fast and give equivalent of a couple meals to help my neighbors when they're struggling. See, I've had leukemia before. And when I had leukemia, the church helped out with food and rent so my life didn't fall apart. I mean, I didn't want them to set me up in a business or something like that, or pay for me to go to school for, you know, 4 years. They just, when I was knocked off my feet, they helped me sustain my life until I got back on my feet. And you know, when I was a kid, we would build our own churches back in the 50s. But now that, because the church has invested in businesses, now the church is doing better to where we don't have to build our own churches. The church, you know, goes around building churches for us to go, and then it has to pay for electricity and books and heating, and it's a place where I can gather with the saints and bring my family, and we can serve one another. I mean, my heart goes out to the previous gentleman. I don't see what this. He obviously was really troubled, and I don't get his trouble. I mean, I have a different perspective than he does, obviously.
I think that's the key, is that your perspective and our perspective is different. You know, like you said, I have never had a problem with giving tithing money, with donating to the welfare program, the perpetual education fund, which so many people have donated to, that now they're saying we don't need that for a while.
On top of tithing.
Right. And to me, I get joy out of knowing that I am helping in some way or another.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm gonna make a bold statement here. I don't think there's any organization in the world that does more good for the world than the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And I consider it a great privilege to be able to donate, to be able to help that organization. The core mission of the church is to help to lead people to Jesus Christ. And so when it builds places of worship, when it builds temples, when it organizes facilities to help to find our ancestors and to do temple work for those ancestors, and then when we reach out to help the poor and the needy, all of that is designed to help lead us to Christ and help us to become more Christ-like, there's nothing better in the world that we could be doing with our money than to be helping in this enterprise.
May I add?
Exactly. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm going to add a point here. I work at the Family History Library in downtown Salt Lake City. So, yes, I am an employee of the church. But this past week, I was helping a lady find her ancestors, who are from Scotland and England. And she was talking and she made the comment something to the idea of, well, I'm not a member of your church. Is that okay? Because I had said something and I guess she assumed, oh, is that only for members? And she said, I'm not a member of your church. Is that okay? And I said, it's fine. I said, we want anyone to come to the Family History Library or to any of the branches that we have. We want them to come and do their family history, and we offered that for free to them. And she said, this is such a wonderful service that you are providing. She said, I can't believe that your church provides this for anyone who wants to come in. And I said, we enjoy having people come in. We don't care what their religious background or if they have no religion at all. And we do that because we have such a strong testimony of the importance of family. And she was extremely grateful. And that was one of numerous experiences I have had where people have said, thank you so much for providing this. And it's back to my comment. I personally get joy out of helping and helping build up the kingdom, but also just helping other people. And I know I'm not alone because I've talked with numerous members who that's the way they feel about their tithing and their other donations.
And you're enjoying your castle up on the hill and driving a Rolls Royce and your airplane that flies around the world. I mean, you're paid so well by the church, aren't you?
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
I mean, the church, people don't realize that the threefold mission of the church, you know, that perfect the saints, you know, redeem the dead, which is what you're involved in. And, oh, I forgot the third area. My mind just went blank.
Proclaim the gospel.
Proclaim the gospel.
And the church has added recently, helping the sick and the afflicted and the poor and the needy. Caller, we appreciate your call. We're going to take a break. Again, this is the Interpreter Radio Show. We look forward to your questions and comments, and we'll talk.
Can I add one more thing?
We'll keep you on through the break. How's that?
Thank you.
Great. Keep. This is the Interpreter Show. We're back. Again, our call-in number is 801-254-1640. If you call us and I answer, you're going right on the air. And this is Steve Densley. I'm here with Craig Foster in the studio. We have Professor Matt Bowen from BYU Hawaii, who's on the phone with us as well. And Matt, you feel free to chime in anytime you like.
Before we go back to the caller, I had a point I think that ties not only to his point, but one that Steve spoke to earlier in terms of the church and the saints in the United States helping to provide for the saints all over the world. It's interesting to take the view of Doctrine and Covenants 104, starting in about verse 14, and looking at it in terms of how the saints in North America, the United States, are helping to support and sustain the work and help the saints all over the world. The Lord says, the Lord stretched out the heavens and built the earth. My very handiwork and all things therein are mine. And it is my purpose to provide for my saints for all things are mine, but it must needs be done in mine own way. And behold, this is the way that I, the Lord, have decreed to provide for my saints, that the poor shall be exalted, in that the rich are made low. For the earth is full, and there is enough to spare. Yea, I prepare all things, and have given unto the children of men to be agents unto themselves. We're, as Latter-day Saints in the United States and Canada, North America, and other places, through the payment of tithes and other contributions, were made a little bit lower in order to help bring up saints all over the world, and I think that's a beautiful thing. I'm grateful to have the opportunity to consecrate and be a part of that.
Well, and that's a great point, Matt, that you know, we talk about the Lord asking for 10%. You know, in some sense, really, the Lord's asking for everything, but then everything we have comes from the Lord. And, you know, and so partly what we're doing here is engaging in an exercise to see where our heart lies. And, you know, what are we going to do with these resources that have been given to us by God? Are we going to use them to help bless the lives of others, help build the kingdom of God? You know, now there's this system that the church has set up where we pay 10% to help build the kingdom through building buildings, where we can meet together, where we can perform ordinances, where we can teach, which is what Professor Bowen is doing at BYU Hawaii, where we can do family history work. You know, so there's certain infrastructure demands. And if you start to go to any charity in the world and look at its books, you know, and try to figure out how much of this money is going to overhead, how much of the money, you know, is going to fundraising. You know, the church has got to match up stellar marks against any charity in the world when we consider things like overhead or how much money it's spending on fundraising. I don't know if you could consider any of the money the church spends as money spent on fundraising. Obviously, there are overhead expenses. You know, we do have paid employees in the church that attend to different things. But when we consider the volunteer activities and the way in which so much of the administration is done through volunteers, you know, a lot of people are critical of the church for how much money it's spending on charities, that it should be spending a lot more. When they do that, they don't take into account how much in kind is donated. You know, how much of my time when I go to my neighbor's house and meet with them when they're sick, or, you know, take them a plate of cookies, or, you know, when I go and I volunteer to, you know, clean up my neighborhood, that doesn't go into any spreadsheet, but those are charitable activities of the church. The entire church itself is a charitable organization. Now, there is some money that the church uses to invest in order to have reserves. I think that's smart. That's what the church should be doing. If it were to spend all of the money that comes through the door as soon as it gets it, it wouldn't have any reserves, and the church would be in dire straits when the times of famine come, right? You know, so I think it's very important, very wise for the church to be investing some of this money, like the wise steward who's investing his talents. And similarly, whenever we hear people say, boy, that money could have been used for the poor, boy, it sure reminds me of when Mary's
John
coming
12.
And anointing the head of Jesus and criticized by, you know, one of the apostles who says, we could have used that money for the poor.
That apostle, according to John, was Judas Iscariot.
Yes.
And there's more than a hint of that he had been engaged in financial mismanagement, that he had been in charge of the funds.
And in lining his own pockets with 30 pieces of silver.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, anyway, let's go back to our caller. You had another comment, caller.
Yes, this is a fallen world. And there's evil and good in all of us. And we want to bind the evil in us, and we want to enhance and act on the good. We want to be disciples of Jesus Christ, and so it's all about character development. you know, develop the character of Jesus Christ and not become like the devil. And so when I was a beach bum surfer, you know, doing high school dropout, doing nothing with my life, the widow's mite, she gave Alden those bags of gold, just given her penny or two, because she gave, you know, everything she had. And the windows of heaven, you know, since I had my spiritual experience, since I started reading the Bible and searching religions and had my spiritual experiences, you know, I've been blessed. And now I'm not a beach bum surfer anymore. I've had different jobs. I've gone up and down. And now God has poured out the windows of blessings upon me in my life now that I'm almost 67. And I might retire. I might keep working. It depends on my grandchildren. But see, when I go and work at the church farm, and then when I go to the cannery, and when we, you know, can beef stew or corn or something, and then the, you know, the church sends it to disasters around the world, you know, doing good in the world. I mean, you know, it, like you said, it's the charity, the amount of money that goes to the people that's hurting. There's no charity in the world that can compare with what the church does. And when I go to my church and I serve each other in callings, teaching the gospel, then I'm growing, like, you know, in character. I'm becoming more like Jesus Christ as I serve. So my life is full. You know, I am so glad that I sought out religions. They all have something to offer. And, you know, I was led to the Church of Jesus Christ. And, you know, that measly 10% that I've given, you know, for the last 40 years to the church, the Lord's rewarded me thousands of times. And I've grown in spirituality, you know, and in my character. I mean, you know, it's all a matter of perspective.
Well, let me ask you this. So would it concern you, or, you know, does it trouble you to learn that, you know, where the church has some excess, you know, maybe from tithing, maybe they've, you know, met the demands of the, you know, the buildings and the, you know, the universities, and so they put some of those tithing funds into reserve. Does it concern you or upset you to learn that some of those reserve funds are invested in stocks and bonds and taxable businesses and agricultural interests and commercial and residential property?
Well, not at all, you know, because as the church grows, they can, the church doesn't have insurance. Like, I have insurance on my house, my car, you know, and the church doesn't have to pay for insurance because it's its own insurance. So when there's a ward building that burns down, that they can sell some stock and rebuild that church. You know, when there's a disaster, you know, in an area from a hurricane or earthquake or something like that, they can sell some stock and go down and rebuild the church in that community. I was a ward finance clerk, and nobody can sign a check. There has to be two people to sign a check, and everything is checked and double checked all the way up. You know, it's we're all engaged in the work of the Lord to help our neighbors and our community and our families, and we're growing. It's look at Joseph Smith, was a uneducated poor farm boy, and now look at this church, this worldwide organization. I mean, I see the hand of the Lord in it, and personally, by committing myself, not only with, you know, my money, but my time and my effort, I have grown. You know, I can't think of any organization I'd rather be a part of that's given back so much to me, you know, in the last 40 years than the LDS Church.
Okay, well, let me ask you this then. In the Desert News in 2007 reported that the City Creek Center was being developed by Property Reserve, Inc., the church's real estate arm. And the money comes from other real estate ventures. So in other words, the money to build City Creek was coming from Property Reserve, Inc. and other real estate ventures. Now, if some tithing funds that were held in reserve happened to have been used to help support Property Reserve Inc. or other real estate ventures. Or let's say we go back to pioneer times, that maybe some of those real estate ventures were purchased with tithing money, and that today some of those real estate ventures are sold in order to help pay for City Creek Mall. Would it concern you that maybe through some circuitous route, some tithing money had ended up to help build City Creek Mall?
Well, no, not at all. And if they asked me to, you know, after work in my spare time on a Saturday, to go down and plant flowers around and beautify the mall, I'd be glad to.
You know, I think that's a great point. You know, in my mind, City Creek Mall is almost tantamount to the flowers that surround the temple. You know, we understand, well, those of us that have faith in the authority of the priesthood understand the importance of what goes on in the temple. And I suppose there are critics of the church that thinks it's a total waste of money to even build temples. But if you could give us that, if you could say a church ought to be able to build churches and temples, then shouldn't the church also be able to beautify the grounds around the churches and temples? And when we talk about City Creek Mall, it is one block over from the temple and from the assembly hall and from Tabernacle, from the Tabernacle Square. And I work in downtown Salt Lake. I've worked in downtown Salt Lake for 20 years, and it was becoming a blighted area in that area just around Temple Square. There were businesses being boarded up. I mean, there was literally plywood over the windows.
It looked horrible, you know, walking down the street or whatever.
Right, and so City Creek Mall has totally renovated that area. It makes it a beautiful location. It's just such a great place to go. You know, we've had a family tradition where we go to downtown Salt Lake, Temple Square, see the lights. It's nice to be able to have someplace nice to go out to eat, do your Christmas shopping.
It's Christmas time.
Right. It's just...
And there's people that come around the world to come and see Salt Lake. And
Number one visitor site in Utah.
Yes.
Like Temple Square. Yeah.
Yes. And do we want all these buildings being boarded up and trashed out and everything? No, and there's a lot of traffic around the temple, so the church helps to build the streets and the traffic lights, you know, to help with should the city pay for that or the church? I don't mind, you know, that the church beautifies it, because I'm paying taxes to the city, you know, I'm paying for both of it. What's the difference? I mean, I want Salt Lake to be a beautiful city, and I'm glad the church brings, you know, businesses in to Salt Lake, and we build things, you know, we create things.
Well, and the New York Times in 2013, you know, after the City Creek project was completed, they said, now through a nation renaissance has taken hold in downtown Salt Lake City, making a stop appealing even outside ski season. Said Salt Lake is really ascending. All the stars seem to be aligned for the future. There's good stuff going on. That's because of the efforts of the church. We appreciate your call, caller. Please stay with us, listeners. We'll be back again at the top of the next hour. We're going to take a break now for commercials and news. This is the Interpreter Radio Show. Please stay with us.
Now, the Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Welcome back to the Interpreter Show. This is Steve Densley. I'm here with Craig Foster. We've got Professor Matt Bowen on the phone. You still there with us, Matt?
Still here.
Great. So our last hour, we were talking about church finances. We want to shift gears now. We're going to talk about a new attack on the Book of Mormon and Jeff Lindsay's response to that attack that's published in the Interpreter's Journal. And just to remind our listeners, the Interpreter Journal publishes a new article every week. It's on Friday. And you can find that at mormoninterpreter.org. You can also find it's mormoninterpreter.com. You can find the website for the Interpreter Foundation at interpreterfoundation.org, and we invite you to visit that site. There's a lot of great information. We just updated an index on the website that helps direct people to resources in their study of gospel doctrine lessons from week to week. There are some great articles that Jeff Bradshaw, one of the vice presidents of the Interpreter Foundation, has been writing every week to go along with gospel doctrine lessons. But then in addition to that, we have roundtable discussions from interpreter scholars. We have links to articles. We have links to other podcasts. So, you know, that Gospel Doctrine Index is a very helpful resource, but there are all sorts of different resources there on the Interpreter Foundation website, and we would sure appreciate your donations. We can't do this without funding, and we've been talking about funding and how it can be used to do great things. You know, we're counseled to do many great things of our own free will, so we don't just rely on the church to do these kinds of things. Private members also put forth their efforts to research gospel topics and to share what they've found with people. And Jeff Lindsay did that. There's an article on Friday. It's called Too Little or Too Much Like the Bible, A Novel Critique of the Book of Mormon Involving David and the Psalms. I'm excited we've got Matt Bowen on the line with us, because Jeff Lindsay actually cites to Matt in a number of different places. But let me just give our listeners an idea of what this article is addressing. And Craig and Matt, you feel free to chime in at any time as we discuss this. I think Jeff raises a lot of really interesting points. But what this article is addressing is a graduate thesis that was produced by an individual named Kevin Beshears. He's a student at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. And what he did was he came up with what he saw as a new devastating critique of the Book of Mormon. The thesis behind his paper is that if the Book of Mormon were authentic, then we would expect the Book of Mormon to emphasize King David and the Psalms, and that since the Book of Mormon does not emphasize David and the Psalms as much as the Bible does, the Book of Mormon must simply be a production of Joseph Smith's mind and not an ancient historical document that was written by people who left Jerusalem in 600 BC. You know, Jeff Lindsay's critique of this paper was so devastating in my mind that I started to feel sorry for this student as I was going through it. You know, so I guess one of the first points that Jeff Lindsay makes about this is that, well, he says that Beshears did, you know, did a literature review, as you often do in a scholarly work, and that Beshears describes LDS scholars in the hopeless position of having no external evidence to offer of any kind of support for the Book of Mormon tale, and thus having no choice but to dig instead within its pages for imagined textual evidence. I suppose he's referring to things like maybe chiasmus or you know, parallelisms that, you know, you find in a text, or Hebraisms. There's some great evidence, internal evidence, within the Book of Mormon that we've emphasized a lot lately. And Beshears is saying, well, the reason you're emphasizing that is because there is no external evidence. And so Jeff Lindsay goes on to list some of the really just striking, impressive external evidence, such as the work by Warren Aston, where he went and explored the Arabian Peninsula and traveled down the frankincense trail down the coast of Saudi Arabia and found sites that track what the Book of Mormon describes in, you know, in 1 Nephi, where you have a site that is very much like the Valley of Lemuel, that you know, a site that's well, you have a burial location where You find an inscription by of Nahum. You find down along the coast of Oban a site that has many interesting parallels between how Bountiful is described and what you find there on the location. But in addition to that, you've got the work of John Sorensen, who published recently Mormon's Codex. You have the work of Brant Gardner, the geological work of Jerry Grover. You have the linguistic work of Brian Stubbs, where he has found that the Udo-Aztecan language has very striking relationships to Hebrew and Egyptian. I thought it was so interesting in a recent interview by one critic of a Mesoamerican scholar, Michael Coe, who Michael Coe is one of the world's foremost Mesoamerican scholars, but he was asked, you know, whether there was any evidence of Hebrew language influence in you know, the languages of Mesoamerica, and he says, well, I don't know, you'd have to ask. I'm forgetting the name of the scholar at BYU, though. He says, yeah, he's the foremost expert in the Mesoamerican language. Interestingly, he did a review of Brian Stubbs' work for the Interpreter Journal recently and reviewed it very favorably. Brian Stubbs' work has been reviewed favorably by non-Mormon scholars. In fairness, I should mention that it hasn't been reviewed in depth yet, but it has not been found lacking. It's just amazing, you know, that we could find these kinds of linguistic connections in Udo-Aztecan languages to Hebrew and Egyptian. And of course, Matt Bowen's done some work on, you know, some of the onomastic wordplay in the Book of Mormon. I guess you'd consider that more of an internal analysis, but I guess it has some external components. But before we leave this first section, Matt, did you have any comments on any of those issues?
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting too how not enough work was done with not only Nephi's psalm, but he tries to play the other side of the fence in the study that Jeff was reviewing, on saying that references to the psalms were from other sources. And one of Jeff's main points is, you know, you can't have it both ways. You can't have it both be too little or too much alike. One of the things I've noticed is that, just as a general observation, is that quotations from the Psalms within the text of the Book of Mormon have criminally been underlooked and underappreciated. It would be fun to have David Larson here to talk about that, who he does so much. He has done a lot recently in terms of looking at the Psalms in the Book of Mormon, as John Hilton has, and John's work comes under critique in the study by Bashir. I think I've got his name right. But one of the things that we see in the Book of Mormon is almost a ubiquitous use of Psalm 95, for example. And as we go along in this discussion, I'll try to point out some other places where I think that the use of the Psalms in the text of the Book of Mormon, that they come at really key moments, and in fact in ways that speak to the importance of the Psalms and David in certain ways that have been overlooked.
Yeah, that's a great point. We just had somebody calling in, and they just dropped off. So let me just remind our callers, we're screening our own calls here. So if we don't answer the phone right away, just hang on there and let it keep ringing, and we'll get to you. So we'd invite you to call in at 801-254-1640. Let me just clarify one of those points you made, Matt. Apparently what Bashir's does in his thesis is that when the Book of Mormon actually does have language in it that is, word for word from the Psalms, then Bashir says, well, that's just plagiarism. And then when the Book of Mormon doesn't have information relating to the Psalms, he says, well, see, you know, that's evidence that there's no connection between the ancient Hebrews and the Book of Mormon peoples. It's either there's too much or too little. But one of the really interesting things, like you say, is some of the creative uses of the Psalms. So not just the word-for-word citations, but sometimes the way thematically that they play in and some of the subtleties. Let me go to a caller. We've got somebody calling in again. Hello, you're on the air with the Interpreter Show. Do you have a question or comment for us?
Well, I'm just trying to figure out what the Book of Mormon was about.
Well, Craig Foster, can you answer that question for us? What was the Book of Mormon about?
Well, the Book of Mormon is about an ancient people. It has to do actually with several groups of people, but to make it a simple thing, they have their origins in the Holy Land. They are of the house of Israel, and they traveled to America.
Well. Can I inject a little bit of why would I become a Mormon?
Well, it's a great question. Have you read the Book of Mormon?
Oh yeah, up and down.
Then why is it you asked us what the Book of Mormon was about?
Well, what do you think Jesus give it to Joseph?
I'm not sure I understand your question. Could you rephrase that?
Well, yeah, I can. What is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints about?
It's about leading people to Jesus Christ.
Well, isn't it about building Zion?
Well, building Zion is one way that we help lead people to Jesus Christ.
So the Jewish Zionist is different from the Mormon Zionist?
Yes. So Jewish Zionists are, you know, that was a movement that was started in the late 1800s to try to lead people back to, you know, what the Jewish people view as their promised land in what we call now the modern state of Israel. That's distinct from what the Mormons talk about when we talk about building Zion.
Well, the 1800s, what happened after Solomon's Temple?
Well, that was a long time ago.
Well, I'm just wondering why all of a sudden Jesus Christ talked to Joseph Smith.
Well, you understand our view of the great apostasy?
No, your understanding, or why don't you give that to me?
Okay, well, so like we were saying, let me put it this way: Jesus Christ came and founded His church and gave His keys to Peter. Are you familiar with that?
No, I haven't talked to Peter for a while.
Okay, well. So when Jesus Christ founded His church with apostles and gave them His authority to direct His church, that lasted for a short time before those keys were lost, those apostles died out, and the teachings of Jesus remained, you know, the basic concept of having a church remained, but because there was nobody to receive revelation from God and nobody to direct the work with the keys, there started to become a wide disagreement about how the church should be run and what she should do. So many different churches began to form. That went on for hundreds of years, up until the time of Joseph Smith in the 1800s, when Joseph Smith was looking around himself trying to decide which church he should join. That's when he prayed to find out which church he should join, because to him it logically didn't make sense that there could be more than one church of Jesus Christ, that there could only be one church of Jesus Christ.
So everything was wrong.
That's right. Let me clarify that. All of the churches taught good things, but they did not have the authority to be able to perform the ordinances necessary to lead people to salvation and to help them to become like Christ. They could all teach good things, but they tended to teach different things. And so that's what led Joseph Smith to pray to find which one to join.
What I don't get, which I do get, is when's the second coming, someone?
Not even the angels know.
Oh, I see that. So, but what about building Zion?
Well, you know, we have been tasked with the responsibility of trying to build a Zion community wherever we live, in the world.
Isn't that what Joseph Smith was supposed to be doing?
Yes.
Building Zion?
Yes.
Well, what happened?
He built it, and he built it again, and he built it again.
But Jesus didn't come.
Yeah, Jesus did come. Jesus and Heavenly Father visited Joseph Smith.
So he came. So I have no worries now.
Well, you don't have any worries if you have joined the church and you're remaining faithful to your covenants. But I'm not talking about Jesus Christ coming in his glory in the second coming. That hasn't happened yet.
That's the one I'm worried about. I'm worried about that big guy coming on that second coming.
Well, there's no need to worry. No need to worry if you're entering
your
in
and pay 10%.
Well, if you're entering into covenants with God and Jesus Christ through His authorized representatives, there is no need to worry so long as you remain faithful to those covenants. We appreciate your call, caller. I think we're going to move on at this time to more discussion of Jeff Livesey's article when we get back from the break. This is The Interpreter Show. Again, our number is 801-254-1640. We're talking about a new attack on the Book of Mormon. Stay with us. This is The Interpreter Show. This is Steve Bensley, Craig Foster, and Professor Matt Bowen from BYU Hawaii. We're talking about a new attack on the Book of Mormon. It comes to us from a graduate student at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, Kevin Beshears. His argument essentially is that the Book of Mormon, if it were a historical document, would contain a significant amount of material, or at least an amount comparable to the Bible in its discussion of David and the Psalms. And so Jeff Livesey addresses the concerns raised by Beshears and does so, in my view, in an utterly devastating way. I just think that there's just no question that Beshears is just way off base once you get finished reading Jeff Livesey's article. And you can read Jeff Livesey's article at the Interpreter Foundation's journals website, mormoninterpreter.com. You could listen to it as a podcast. If you go to iTunes, or you could go to our website to find the RSS feed, you can get an audio upload of each journal article that comes out every week. Go right to your phone or iPod. You can listen to it on your computer. You can download these articles on your Kindle, You can get them in a variety of different formats. In my view, it's the most technologically advanced journal in the world. I invite anybody to correct me on that, because I just don't know of any journal that offers its content in so many different forms. And it's a great way of staying up to date on the most recent Mormon studies information and information defending the church. Now, we have a new caller, and I'm going to bring him online. Caller, you're on the air. You had some comments about the Book of Mormon and some of the things that we've been talking about with the Psalms. What was your comment?
Well, interestingly enough, that doesn't ever come up with me. That's just not been an issue related to the Psalms. And I know Jacob, I guess the second chapter of Jacob mentions David and Solomon and their concubines, and that's mentioned there, but the Psalm issue doesn't come up. There's a lot, some interesting things I've read, read the Book of Mormon, some interesting things about the Nephite record, particularly in the, in Nephi's day. Not only is Isaiah mentioned in the Nephite record in 2 Nephi, but throughout the record of the Book of Mormon, the Law of Moses is mentioned quite a bit. I don't know, that's details in like the Bible, but it's mentioned that they keep the Law of Moses until Jesus came, and it's talked about there. What is, where it's not mentioned is in the Jaredite record, where I guess the Jaredite record may have been earlier than Moses, but the Law of Moses is not mentioned in the Jaredite record yet in the Bible. We know that even Adam was told to sacrifice and do sacrifices. But the Jaredites, what we know is they came on the promised land and they prayed, and the Jaredites prayed. We know that when Nephi came, he actually prayed and said, or Lehi, or Nephi wrote that they actually prayed and did sacrifices unto the Lord our God. So we know that Nephi mentions it. But it's interesting what your comments might be. The Jaredite record is not mentioned, and sacrifices aren't mentioned either in the Jaredite record. There's nothing wrong with that. I just wondered what your comments would be on that part of it and the Jaredite record.
Well, it's a very interesting observation that we don't find, you know, references to David or the Psalms in the Jaredite record. Matt Bowen, do you have some comments on the caller's question?
Yeah, we don't see a lot of cultic or ritual material in the Jaredite record, other than, you know, what is mentioned in Ether 8 about the formation of secret combinations. I think largely that's because Moroni is giving us a very abridged kind of a record in the Book of Ether, and also there's some evidence that he may have been composing that, at least parts of it anyway, from memory. We don't know all of the records that he was able to take with him when he's moving around and trying to complete the record. We know that from the Book of Mosiah that Mormon intended to have the Jaredite story told, and that's one of the things that Moroni does before he makes a complete finish of the record, but it's very abbreviated, and that's one of the reasons you don't see a lot of descriptions of temples or, you know, ritual sacrifices or other kinds of rites in there. There's another point that Jeff Lindsay made that I think is worth calling attention to, because it pertains to the Jaredite issue as well. he noted that even in the biblical record that kingship in ancient Israel was not necessarily synonymous with Davidic kingship, and that's an important point. Because when, you know, the Nephites established their society, it's not a Davidic kind of kingship. In fact, the issue only really, the Davidic issue comes into play again in subtle ways with the Nephites encountering the descendants of Mulek or Moloch, and who it was a descendant of David. And it's interesting to me, and I intend to pursue this later as a study at some point. I think it's really interesting. I've already written on the use of Psalm 2 and 2 Samuel 7, or in specifically Psalm 2 verse 7 and 2 Samuel 7:10, which are two important Davidic texts that King Benjamin makes reference to in the conclusion of his speech at the temple in Zarahemla to a group that is composed of probably ethnic Nephites, Mulekites, and other people. And it's interesting that King Benjamin takes great pains to democratize the idea of kingship in that setting. We know even a generation later, Mosiah is still having great difficulty blending those two, at least the two major portions of that society together. He has to address them in two bodies, and the fight over kingship at the beginning of the Book of Alma with Amalekai probably speaks to a continuing trouble in terms of blending those two societies and the issue of the right to rule. Well, the Mulekites, if they would be, especially those that hadn't accepted Nephite kingship with Mosiah the First and King Benjamin, or Mosiah the Second, that they would be interested in those Davidic texts. But Mormon doesn't take a lot of interest in telling us a lot about that. We have to just look and see where they're quoting the Psalms. Two big instances are, the caller mentioned Jacob 2. It's really in before Jacob 5 and Jacob 4 where we get some quotation of the Psalms, and in particular Psalm 95 and in Jacob chapter 6. Then later on, Alma will make extensive use of Psalm 95 in Alma chapter 12 through 13, where he brings in a lot of Melchizedek material, which bears on a lot of other important issues pertaining to kingship and priesthood. And this is where, and this in a context where he is addressing Nephites who belonged to the order of Nehor, and there may be a connection with the Mulekites there as well, as there was with Amalekai earlier in the Book of Alma.
Well, and it's interesting too how these references in Jacob and Nephi and in Alma 29, it's unlike the references to Isaiah, where, you know, Nephi just, you know, wholesale quotes entire chapters one after the other of Isaiah. The use of the Psalms in the Book of Mormon is much more subtle. And one of the really significant aspects of the Book of Mormon is Nephi's psalm itself. It's not in the Book of Psalms, but it follows the pattern that we find in the Psalms. And it's you know, one of the most beautiful psalms in all of Scripture, you know, clearly influenced by this tradition of writing psalms. So when Bashir goes to the Bible and says that there are you know, over 1,000 times that David is mentioned in the Bible, you know, and criticizes the Book of Mormon because it's not mentioning David all the time and not, you know, quoting the Psalms all the time. One of the really interesting points that Jeff Lindsay makes is that the bulk of these references to David is when we're telling the story of David. So you would expect to see references to David under those circumstances, and, you know, where the Book of Mormon is not recounting the story of David, you wouldn't expect that there would be the same kind of references. So then when we move on from the story of David, when, you know, he's referenced in Samuel and some Kings and Chronicles, and then, you know, of course, the Psalms themselves that sometimes reference themselves as being a Psalm of David, we don't find more than a handful of mentions in Isaiah or Jeremiah or Ezekiel. And then we don't find David mentioned at all in Esther, Lamentations, Daniel, Joel, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Zephaniah, Haggai, Malachi. So would Bashir's just write all of these books off because they're not mentioning David? And then when we move to the New Testament, we do have some significant references to David in Matthew. Now, it's six references. But the point Matthew's trying to make is that Jesus Christ is the prophesied Messiah. He is the of the lineage of David. So, you know, Matthew really emphasizes this point that this is the coming of the Jewish Messiah. But then the Gospel of John mentions David twice. Paul mentions David three times in Romans, but not at all in the Corinthians letters, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, 1 Thessalonians, 2 Thessalonians, or 1 Timothy. He makes an offhand reference in 2 Timothy, but nothing in Titus or Philemon. David's mentioned twice in Hebrews, but there's no mention of David in James, 1 Peter, 2 Peter, the third epistles of John and Jude, and then Revelations has three mentions. So should we discount all of these as being historical documents on the basis that they don't mention David or the Psalms?
Well, if we're going to use Bashir's line of thinking, yeah, you know, let's start ripping the pages out.
Yeah, so, you know, the point that Jeff Lindsay makes about that particular argument of Bashir's is, like I said, I think it's just really devastating, you know, to say that since the Book of Mormon doesn't have these references that we see in, you know, in Chronicles or Kings or in the Psalms, that it must not be historical or authentic. You know, one of the other really interesting points he makes is that, you know, our Old Testament, you know, that we have now, to some degree, you know, may, well, certainly is politically influenced, you know, that there are, you know, different groups as they are pulling together the scriptures over time that have different biases or, you know, different agendas in choosing the books that they do or putting together the stories in the way that they do. It may very well be that, you know, maybe a Davidic emphasis that we might see in the Old Testament is the result of, you know, a certain group that maybe is trying to elevate the status of David as the king. You know, he was of the tribe of Judah.
But what's interesting there is, and I dealt with this quite a bit in my doctoral dissertation, was that even among, you know, the so-called Deuteronomists, or those, you know, sometimes the historians referred to as the Deuteronomistic historian, as a single person, or maybe at least a single point of view, there's plenty of criticism of David along the lines of what you find in Jacob 2, in terms of David isn't exclusively or uniformly praised in that material. He is praised for, there is no criticism of him in terms of his loyalty to Yahweh, but there is criticism in terms of the kind of moral criticism that Jacob levies against David and Solomon in Jacob chapter 2.
Yeah, yeah, fascinating. And we should mention, too, that Nephi, his family, Lehi, Ishmael, they were not of the tribe of Judah. So we might not expect them to be emphasizing the same kinds of things that those of the tribe of Judah would emphasize. They may have more affinity for those of northern tribes. But anyway, there's a lot of sophistication here going on. We'll return again after the break. This is the Interpreter Show. We look forward to your questions or comments. This is the Interpreter Show. This is Steve Densley with Craig Foster and with Professor Matt Bolin. You can call us at 801-254-1640. And we apologize for our bumper music. This is not our choosing. It's not something we can change. It's kind of out of character with what we're talking about. But we're talking about the Scriptures. And we're talking about, in particular, an article that was published in the Interpreter Foundation Journal on Friday, found at interpreterfoundation.org, about a critique of the Book of Mormon by an evangelical student who says that the Book of Mormon just doesn't have enough references to David and the Psalms. And we have a caller that I assume wants to address that issue. I'll bring him online. Caller, you're on the air. Do you have a question or comment for us about David and the Psalms and the Book of Mormon? Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Okay, wonderful. Yes, I have to say, as far as the Book of Mormon and it being a history, first I'd like to say that the things of the Spirit, can only be understood by the Spirit. And one of the previous callers that was asking about purpose of the Book of Mormon and different things, in the last 40 years, I've grown spiritually drop by drop by drop, and I've been able to pierce the veil, slowly here, slowly there, as I'm growing spiritually.
So, caller, your phone is giving us some trouble. I assume that...
How's this?
Oh, that's better.
Is that better?
That's better. Yeah.
Oh,
so
wonderful.
Now, what you're saying then is that the spiritual aspect, I guess, of the Scriptures is important. Is that what I got from what you're saying?
Yes, the things of the Spirit can be only understood by the Spirit. In the last 40 years, I've grown drop by drop spiritually by being a disciple of Jesus Christ and serving in the church, and practicing. Getting promptings from the Holy Ghost. And one of the last callers was talking about, the purpose of the Book of Mormon. And, I'm not trying to insult him, but I didn't sense any spirituality in that man. We're all in a fallen world. And Jesus came to help us overcome the fall. And we develop spiritual sensitivity, drop by drop. And then we can only understand the things of God, the things of the Spirit, through the Spirit. So, I'm so glad that I, have been serving in the church and have been growing spiritually. The point I want to get to mainly is that the gentleman who wrote an article against the Book of Mormon, saying that there's not a lot of historical evidence, the thing that he doesn't realize is that Nephi did. I know you, brother, know this, but Nephi did keep a historical record. The Book of Mormon was not so much a historical record as it is a record of their spiritual experiences. And someday when we get the historical record, we can compare it with the Bible. The Bible is more of a historical record, but it does have sprinkles of the Messiah in the Old Testament, and then of course the New Testament is all about the Son of God. And so, when they're trying to look at it as a historical record, they're going about it wrong. It's a spiritual record of spiritual experiences and the war with evil and the coming of Christ. And it's interesting that people don't realize that, you know, the Jews in the Old Testament, they didn't ever seem to reach a level of living the spirit of the law. It seems like they were always struggling on a low, you know, level, the Aaronic priesthood of living the letter of the law. And they failed at that terribly. We all fail at that terribly. But the main point I want to get to here is that, you know, in Lehi's time, they were given, you know, knowledge of the Savior 600 years before Jesus Christ, which is seems to be hardly in the Old Testament, just vaguely of a Messiah. But in the Book of Mormon, you know, Jesus came and set up a kingdom living the spirit of the law before his death and after his death. But in the Book of Mormon, 600 years before Christ, they were living a higher law, the spiritual law. They weren't above the Jews, not just living the letter of the law. And it showed also the Book of Mormon, you know, about another testament of Jesus Christ, you know, and how the Savior brings us up to live in a higher law, a spiritual law. And the last point I want to make is that reading the Book of Mormon, you know, in this world, my heart was stone. It was dead. I was a fallen man. It was stone. And when I read the Book of Mormon, it taught me how to open my heart to God. And when I opened my heart to God, then slowly, drop by drop in the last 40 years, God gave me a new heart, a living heart, a spiritual heart. And it has brought me to Jesus Christ. And now I have a hope. I'm living in this life with a resilient hope of eternal salvation.
Well, we appreciate your call. That's a great message, and I appreciate you sharing it. You know, what our caller is saying about hard-heartedness, you know, stony heart versus a fleshy heart, that's one of the predominant messages of the Book of Mormon. You know, Nephi again and again is telling his brothers, harden not your hearts, you know, and then we see that later in the Book of Mormon, reemphasized again and again. And I think that that's so significant that the Book of Mormon is imploring us to soften our hearts, because so often the reason people are not accepting the message of the Book of Mormon is they're hardening their hearts against it. I see that, that's what's happening, I think, with David Beshears here in his article, is that he can study the Book of Mormon and not be affected by its message of Jesus Christ, because he's hardening his heart against it. And so he's looking for things to help prove what he's already decided about the Book of Mormon, and the message of the Book of Mormon isn't getting through to him because he's hardening his heart against it.
And it's interesting that you, that both the caller and you addressed that point, because Psalm 95, and one of the parts that's quoted the most in the Book of Mormon from Psalm 95 is Psalm 95, 7 and 8, today, if you will hear his voice, harden not your hearts. Harden not your heart as in the day of provocation and as in the day of temptation in the wilderness. That's quoted again and again and again in the Book of Mormon, and often in connection with that idea.
Well, now you wrote a paper on that, didn't you, Matt?
I've included Psalm. Psalm 95 itself is so prevalent in the Book of Mormon. In a lot of what I've written, I point that out where it's being referenced. I needed to correct one scriptural citation I gave earlier. It wasn't 2 Samuel 7:10, but 2 Samuel 7:14 was the reference in that's alluded to in Mosiah chapter 5, that is another one of those important Davidic texts. But it's you hear the writers of the Book of Mormon pleading with us, using the language of Psalm 95 again and again to not harden our hearts. They look back to the history of Israel in the wilderness and what kept them there for the 40-year wandering period. And again the plea comes to us to harden not our hearts. so that we can, as also alluded to in Psalm 95, verse 11, that we might be able to enter into his rest rather than to be excluded from that.
Well, and that message of not harming your hearts, I think that, that applies not just to whether or not we accept the Book of Mormon, but, you know, last hour we were talking about the finances of the church and how some people get offended at different ways in which the church is using the church's money, you know, thinking that, you know, that boy, if I were in charge, I'd be using that money the right way. To me, that evinces a certain hardness of heart, that we're saying, I know better than the leaders of the church how this should be run. And, you know, I think that if you do have an open heart, a humble heart, that it's going to be easier not to be offended, you know, not easily offended, and, you know, quick that, to... go ahead, Matt.
I was just going to say, it's interesting to me how much of Jesus' teachings in the New Testament deal with where are we at in our hearts. He's constantly frustrated by the hardness of heart in some of the religious leaders and others that he's attempting to teach and to help and to minister to. But so much of it, of what he teaches, goes to where are our hearts at. He wants us to not appear to be disciples, but to really be disciples from the innermost parts of our hearts and beings, that we really can become as he is and to become the real thing. And it has everything to do with our heart.
Right.
Our hearts are susceptible to the most negative things about human nature and this fallen world, as has been mentioned. But if he can get a hold of our hearts and if we yield our hearts to God, and that's another phrase that comes out of the Book of Mormon, yield the sanctification that comes, Mormon talks about, that comes from yielding our hearts to God, makes all the difference.
Right, or the parable of the sower, you know, in Matthew 13, where the seed's being sown on different types of soil. It's all representative of different kinds of hearts that we have. We have another caller, and we just have a few more minutes. Let me bring them on the line. Oh, they just dropped off. Now they're back on. Caller, you're on the air. Do you have a question or comment for us?
I'm sorry. This is Truck Driver Ray again for the third time. And let me just say quickly that it's all about a spiritual journey. We have a spirit inside of us, and the world doesn't get it. You know, even though we're living in a physical existence, we are trying to take a spiritual journey, not a science journey, not a journey of science, of empirical evidence or measured evidence, that this is a spiritual journey. And the Book of Mormon helps us make that spiritual journey to Christ.
Well, I think that's right. I think that when we emphasize the spiritual nature of it, of course, we shouldn't discount or reject the intellectual component, you know, that we're supposed
exactly.
to worship God with our heart and might and mind and strength, and that all of these different elements combine to help to form a strong, lasting testimony and conviction of the truth. And
exactly.
Hopefully that's what we're doing with the Interpreter Foundation, is helping to contribute to the intellectual development of commitment to the church and understanding of the gospel. But it's essential.
Very important.
Yeah, and I think, like you say, Ray, it's essential that in addition to the intellectual foundation, that we also build the spiritual foundation, and, you know, those support one another and form a symbiotic whole. Yeah, well,
we
appreciate your call, Ray. We appreciate all the other callers.
Good to be with you.
We look forward to joining you again next week on the Interpreter Show. Heather and Isabella, take the chocolate chip cookies out of the oven. I'll be home soon.